From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today we're continuing our ongoing series, Art at the Intersection. Art at the Intersection explores the ways the arts can help shape, inspire, and communicate the work being done in many areas of society, like in city planning, infrastructure design, public spaces, conservation, and so on. Forklift Dance Works in Austin, Texas is a great example of how art can operate at the intersection. As Forklift's founder and artistic director Allison Orr says, the company makes dances with people you might not think of as dancers, but are movement experts, embodying the jobs that they do. Forklift creates community-based dance performances with workers that show their skilled movements and tell the often unheard stories of the people whose jobs actually sustain our daily lives. The workers collaborate with the artistic team at Forklift to create the dances, and then the workers themselves perform them. The result is a visually stunning, often moving exploration of the unnoticed work and workers that make our lives possible. It opens our eyes to what and who are in front of us. Here's Artistic Director Allison Orr to tell us more about the work at Forklift, beginning with its many collaborators.
So we, in our 20 plus years now of making dances like this, have worked with sanitation workers, firefighters, people and their dogs, maintenance men, grounds crews, urban forestry crews, aquatics professionals, and lifeguards. And we're presently collaborating with Austin's Watershed Protection Department. So most of our collaborators have been government staff, so employees of the city of Austin primarily, or employees of other organizations like campus custodial staff or cleaning crews, grounds crews, maintenance crews. We like to say that we are inspired by the movement of ordinary life and work. And we collaborate with movement experts, people who have an embodied career of movement expertise. I think the number one criteria is that we really are working with people who are movement experts, who movement is central to their job. And we work with these collaborators to support them to share their stories and their contributions to our communities on their own terms.
Well, putting this together, I know, is a multi-step and complicated process. Your latest project is The Way of Water, which received funding from the Arts Endowment. So maybe we can take that as an example, and you can walk me through the process from idea phase to fruition.
Oh, sure. So, well, it'd be great to talk about the new project. So The Way of Water is a global project exploring water and the work of people who steward it. And it's been really in our minds, and when I say our, I mean me as artistic director and our associate artistic director, Chrissy Marty, along with our leadership team, board, and other collaborators. We've been talking for years about how we might begin to make work that addresses what's happening on our planet and climate change from the perspective of frontline workers and communities who are directly experiencing increased risk for flooding, in particular challenges around water, be it too much or too little. So this project really launched this year with a performance just a couple weeks ago here in Austin, but we began meeting with the Watershed Protection Department and talking to leadership there really in 2019. So our projects take years to conceive and plan, and we like to partner with our collaborating groups, be they community members, neighbors, work staff, for years, because it really takes time to build the kind of relationships that we need to do the work that we do. So the first part of the process really is us as artists thinking about, what are we curious about? What are we interested to learn? Where is there maybe a problem we've begun to learn about an issue that could use help in terms of greater public awareness or even just understanding? And when I think about climate change, I know my attention span to even read an article about the topic is pretty limited. So we began to think about how could we help people understand what's happening with water in our city and around the world. And it seemed like the place to start is to work with the experts, the people in watershed protection, and particularly the employees who are confronting those challenges really day to day in their work.
And you don't just chat with them and observe them. You often physically do the work with them. So you have a sense of the way that work feels in your own body.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's really the second and really most intensive part of our process is job shadowing and relationship building. So we like to spend, if we have the time, at least a year with a collaborating work group so we can go out on route with them, so we can go out in the field, we can attend safety trainings, we can get signed off to do as much of the work as we can safely do, knowing that, you know, we're not going to have a commercial driver's license, we're not going to operate the equipment, but maybe we can ride on the back of the truck, maybe we can, you know, drag brush, maybe we can clean the pool. Or in this case, with watershed protection, pick up trash. A lot of the crews that we've been working with are in charge of really maintaining water quality and cleaning up after, you know, all of us in our city and the trash that inevitably blows from the streets into the creeks and ultimately into our, what we call a town lake, but it's really the Colorado River. So we, as best we can, we do the work too, so that we can really understand it also from a body level. We can then really work closely with our collaborators to figure out how to show that work in interesting ways. And again, we're making a show that's, you know, maybe 45 minutes or an hour long. So we're taking often what takes hours to do and trying to condense the main ideas into just a few minutes. So it's important that we know how to do the work, or we've experienced it ourselves.
So also, unlike what we think of as a choreographer who makes a dance on someone, you actually make a dance with them and you work together to show what movements best illustrate what it is they do.
Exactly. And that is the fine art of doing it. And that's why it's important that we've built a trusting relationship with our collaborators, because then we're going to ask them to try things that maybe aren't exactly like what they do at the work. So it takes that trust and that back and forth where I'm coming into their world as a novice. I am really guided by and following their expertise. But at some point we begin to make the show, and that's where they have to trust me and us as choreographers at Forklift to represent them well, and to bring our own expertise to the process of, like, how do you shape something to be interesting in terms of space, time, and energy? So it is definitely a back and forth. They're going to perform the movement. We don't have trained dancers pretending that they are sanitation workers or firefighters or power linemen. We have the actual experts themselves. So they have to feel comfortable with it. It has to feel authentic to their experience. And it has to be performable in a limited amount of time, because we can't take months and months to rehearse. We often just get days. So it is a real back and forth together. It's a real collaboration to come up with the final product.
You've worked with composer Graham Reynolds for many, many years. When does he come into this process?
Yeah, I was really fortunate to begin collaborating with Graham in 2008 when we premiered The Trash Project, which was the performance with the sanitation department here in Austin. He composed original music that was performed live. And since then, he is the chief composer for all of our work. And he's a great composer for dance, because he knows about how to tell story through music. And our work, even though it's not always directly narrative, it is really guided by the stories of our collaborating partner. The employees are not dancing to the music. The music is following their movement. So Graham, we start a good 6 months out, if not earlier, talking about the feeling of this show, right? And the stories, kind of the tone, the themes of this project. And then we go out into the field and we take videos. We take videos of the crews in action, of the work happening, and then we begin to generate a list of what might be some of the movement palette. And we show those videos to Graham, and he really uses those videos to guide him. So he's not coming up with music on his own in the studio. He, like we are in the field, is really guided by what he sees in front of him in terms of the work, and then helps to showcase that through his music. Again, it's a back and forth. Often he asks questions and interviews the employees themselves. What music would you like here? It's not unusual that we get to the show and we've thought of some music, and then he tries a certain, you know, score or theme to a particular section and it doesn't work. And he'll go up and he'll talk with the employees about, well, what do you think would go here? And again, he's great at dialogue and at exchange. And that just happened, you know, in our recent show where we tried something Monday and Tuesday, and we could tell Tuesday night it didn't work. And on Wednesday we tried something different, and that was spot on.
And the workers, the employees, your collaborators, they also talk about the work as it's being performed. You have unscripted recordings of them speaking about what it is they do as the show is unfolding.
Exactly. Yeah. So I have a background in ethnography and anthropology. And so my first tools were really what I learned in college and doing field work myself in terms of interviewing people. And as a cultural anthropologist, really trying to, again, understand the stories and the experience and the voices of the community that I decided to learn about. So in many ways, it's a similar process where I don't usually do those recorded interviews early in the process of getting to know a work group. It comes later once we've established that trust and they feel more comfortable around us. I don't want people to feel studied or that somehow, you know, they're on display or it's, you know, again, it needs to come from them feeling this is an opportunity for them to tell their story, which takes time to build that kind of a relationship. So often we sit in the truck, I'll have a little recording device, maybe we'll be in the break room, and there's some standard questions that we ask. And then we really follow the lead of the collaborator. But often we like to know, you know, what do people love about their work? What is it that they want the public to know? And what's something that's hard or challenging? Again, what's something they'd like the public to know, both in a positive way, but also in where they could use a hand, where they could use some help, where the public maybe doesn't seem to quite understand the nature of the job. So that's often where we start, and then we see where they lead us. And those stories end up coming into the performances at certain times to help create a fuller picture of what you're seeing in front of you.
Allison, tell me, I want to know a little bit more about you. What drew you to this work? You mentioned you studied cultural anthropology. Was dance also a part of your life? Or mm-hmm. Tell me the story.
Yes, well, I'll give you the abridged version. But yes, yeah, so I grew up dancing. I mean, I was that kid who took, you know, tap, jazz, and ballet. You know where you had the ballet bag that had the place for the ballet shoes and then the place for the tap shoes? You know, my mom took me to the studio, you know, down the street. I didn't go to the ballet school. I mean, I didn't have a pedigreed, I would say, background in movement, but I always loved to move, and I particularly loved to make shows. So whenever my grandparents came to town, my sister and I would always put on shows for them. And I would, you know, choreograph to my parents' record collection, you know, the Beatles and lots of other music from the 60s. And then when I got to high school, you know, in Texas, I had flat feet. I was never really a technical dancer, or at least I wasn't going to be a ballet dancer. I knew that. And so I was on the drill team. And that is really, it's a group of about 50 young women who perform highly regimented dances, often at football half times or other sports events or during the spring competition season. And it was my whole life. We were very spectacle-oriented. Listeners might know of the Kilgore Rangerettes, which are kind of a world-famous drill team out of Kilgore Junior College in East Texas. We were really modeled after that. That's where my director went. And, you know, it was just about how big and how good could you be? And we were top five in Texas. So, you know, I like to say we might have lost the football games, but we always won the halftime. That was our motto. So when I got to college And I learned that there was modern dance where you could actually make a dance about something. I was really blown away. And so I was part of the dance company, even though, again, I wasn't a technical powerhouse. You know, nobody ever said, oh, Allison, you're going to be a professional dancer. I never saw myself in the professional dance world as I understood it. So I, at the same time, was studying anthropology. I thought I wanted to go into public health. And when I graduated from college, I actually worked as a social worker because I was bilingual. I had spent summers doing public health work in Latin America, really doing community-based organizing. So I kind of had these two threads, this love of dance and movement, and really this love of community and storytelling. And it wasn't really until in my late 20s that I began to see that they could come together. And I took a leap of faith and I went to graduate school in choreography at Mills College. And there I learned that, oh my God, there is this whole process of community-based dance making. I didn't know it existed. And it really brought my love of community and dance and performance together.
And Liz Lerman, who's a MacArthur Genius Awardee and who really expanded the notion of community dance with her various collaborations, she was really influential, wasn't she, in your development of Forklift and the way you thought about this work?
Absolutely. So I stumbled upon her work. My choreography teacher taught me about her. Again, I was oblivious to the work of her or, you know, Jale Zolarn, Urban Bush Women, or Ann Carlson, Marty Pottinger. I mean, there's a vast field, right? Like Marty Pottinger likes to say community-based art making is both an ancient and new field of art making, and that it's probably the way we did it thousands of years ago, in the sense that we didn't necessarily have people that were quote-unquote professionals and, you know, did it all. People more commonly participated, right, in creative expression. So I began to study the field, learn about the pioneers, people like Liz Lerman, and then I planted myself on her doorstep and was like, can I be your intern? Can I be your babysitter? What can I do? And I ended up being both intern and babysitter, and really learned and studied from her many life lessons for about a year, and then ended up coming back to Austin and settling back at home and just starting to cobble things together. But she continues to be a champion for our work and a huge influence on me and so many people. I'll be always grateful to really the pathway that she and others like her forged for people like me, where this kind of art making, I think, has finally really, because of her and many others' tenacity, been given some legitimacy in the more conventional or traditional dance and funding worlds for art.
So you have an idea for Forklift. You return to Austin, and it's one thing to have this great idea, but then you have to make it happen and bring it into this world. So how did you even know how to begin?
Well, that is really the question. And I would say, again, I never had a grand plan. I felt like I was muddling along the entire time. And I mean, one strategy that I continue to employ, and I, you know, is that I bring experts. I surround myself with brilliant people and experts. And early on, certainly Liz, watching her and how she built allies and support for herself, and then really going and using whatever resource came my way. So whenever there was an offer of a little bit of cash to pay a consultant to help me write a strategic plan, you know, I applied to the city. Whenever there was a workshop on how you build a nonprofit board, I showed up. I just really immersed myself also in the business of running a nonprofit. The first 15 years, though, of more or less a Forklift, 12, 13, I actually didn't get paid. I was working as an adjunct faculty member at Austin Community College in the dance department and did other teaching around town. And fortunately, my husband had a job that could help underwrite our expenses. You know, many people, many artists can't live like that. So I was privileged in that way, certainly. I'm also local, grew up in Austin. So I had a lot of connections through my family with press and potential donors and supporters. So that certainly benefited me. But it has just taken along the entire way, really building a support group of people who could advise me, including the board. And, you know, that's a whole separate skill set. But I think when I think about artists and what we need often, it's that those business skills, like it's the fundraising and the admin is in the end. What's the hard part? The art making is the fun part. You know, it's why we're in it. So gradually the company grew. And then I would say the big turning point was in 2010 when Chrissy Marty called me. And Chrissy had been at the Dance Exchange with Liz and Celeste Miller, who is another artist who works in this fashion and was a real mentor to Chrissy. Well, so at that time, I was directing a project called 200 Two-Steppers on the steps of the Texas Capitol. And it was a performance to kick off the Fusebox Festival, a local arts festival. And it was a challenge. I mean, I had 200 two-steppers. It was kind of like high school prom, everybody wanting to dance with somebody else and wanting to do a certain number. It was a challenge. It was fun, but there were challenges. And I was just me. And so she showed up the day of the show on our, you know, single rehearsal, all of us on the steps of the Capitol, and she started fixing things. I looked over and I was like, oh my God, she actually knows what to do. And so we began to figure out how to get her on board, writing grants, a lot of grant writing, got actually some money to do creative movement. Chrissy is a real educational specialist, and gradually figured out how to get her full time. And by 2015, she was full time. And I think if you look at our growth, you'll see that that has a whole lot to do with it. We're now 5 full time. We're going to be 6 full time employees next year, and 3 artists and 3 kind of fundraiser administrative people. And, you know, I, again, it's gradual growth. It's planning, it's budgeting, it's all those things that you learn when you read those books about how to run a nonprofit.
I would imagine in the beginning, you had to have confronted so many layers of skepticism from the administrators of, for example, city departments to the workers themselves.
Absolutely. I mean, we still get skepticism every single time a project starts. And with every project, I have my own personal breakdown that this is going to be the one that falls flat on its face and will be a disaster. And now it's gotten a little easier because we have a track record, but we still, because it's a new employee group, every time have to earn trust by doing. What has gotten easier is that I have the kind of proof of concept, right? And I use, particularly in Austin, you know, working with one group, one work group, and having that leadership call the next work group leadership and vouching for us. And really, that's how I got it. So the sanitation department project was really transformational for us. The trash project really changed everything for lots of reasons. But one thing that made it happen is that my lead contact with the fire department happened to be neighbors with the comms PR person for sanitation. And he walked across the street and said to his neighbor, you know, she's not crazy. You should take her call. And so eventually she did. And after a year of phone calls and emails with her, I finally got a meeting and I finally got to pitch. And then that took about 6 months of her hemming and hawing with her leadership when I finally got to meet with the whole team. So it was close to a 2-year process of even just getting my foot in the door to allow me to be in the workspace.
The project you did at Wake Forest University had to have been particularly gratifying since you went to school there.
Yes. Yes. And I was a typical college student in that I had a lot of issues with the org, you know, with the institution. I was a protester. It was great. Actually, it was really fun to protest at Wake Forest because there weren't a lot of us doing that. And so you got a lot of attention from especially the faculty when you took an interest in political ideas. But I never expected that I would go back to campus in that way. But we ended up collaborating with over 70 campus employees who worked in grounds, custodial, and maintenance and construction. And some of those employees were actually there when I was a student. And you know, as a student, you know, you're thinking about yourself. It never occurred to me to think about who was cleaning the dorm or who was fixing, you know, repairing the, you know, the broken sink. That I got to meet employees, of course, get to know them and build relationships. That was really priceless. I felt like I have a whole different understanding of how the campus works that I didn't get when I was there. So it was a great project. It was a gift to get to go back to campus and do that.
I think anyone who has seen a forklift dance work knows they're visually stunning, but You also know that the aesthetics of community dance is often questioned, frequently sight unseen. And I wonder how you discuss the aesthetics of what you do, which has importance. It's a piece of creative art.
That is such a great question. And I remember watching Liz really struggle with this, and that there is a way that people think, particularly folks who are in the dance world, how something's supposed to look when it is with people who may not think of themselves as professional performers. So I think what is unique about us at Forklift, and this probably comes a little bit from my background and Chrissy's back, you know, Chrissy was a twirler for the marching band and Spun Fire. She was a third generation twirler. So we both have this real love of spectacle and of big and of trying to pull off something impossible. So there's that, but I think of it as we are trying to create art and aesthetically match the skill, expertise, and just, you know, I don't know, badassness, vastness, hugeness, size of our collaborating work group. So when you work with the sanitation department, well, you've got to have a bunch of trucks and you got to show all the great things that they do. Same if you're working with, you know, Austin Energy, our public power company here in Austin. They want to impress. You know, Marty Pottinger likes to say everybody wants to do great things. Nobody wants to get up in front of a group of people and have it be mediocre. And so we really bring to bear all the skills of art and theater making. That's why we work with live music. That's why I figured that out. That live music makes all the difference. It elevates the aesthetic inherently, right? And then I work with a lighting designer who can do large scale productions. And so we bring in, you know, film generators and all kinds of things to, again, match the skill and the scale of what the work group is wanting to show off and to demonstrate to the public. When we worked with Austin Energy, we had, I think, again, over 75 employees participating. But say, so you've got transmission linemen that work with bucket trucks that go up to, you know, 150 feet or more in the air. And you work with a substation lineman who, you know, work with highly dangerous equipment moving around on genie lifts and all kinds of things. And then you've got the distribution linemen who go to competition rodeos every year where they do timed events climbing the poles. I mean, what choreographer? This is like a dream come true, you know, and then you've got the underground network crews that do all this amazing, you know, tunnel work. We had to do this out on the scale of a football field with a massive lighting display. You couldn't not do that. So I think we try to match what the community is showing us, and we bring everything we've learned as artists to bear to make it look grand and beautiful and intimate. And so I think our aesthetic is a lot about, gosh, this is a really good question. Aesthetic is definitely about creating awe and wonder.
Here's the thing, that's the other side of this, because it really strikes me that as a country, we don't value physical work. We rarely acknowledge it. We rarely see it. And Forklift demands that we do, and that we see not only its significance, but the beauty that it actually can be, and the joy and the necessity that it
yes,
is.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear over and over again in terms of workforce development, how desperately we need people who are willing to be firefighters and power linemen and sanitation workers and truck drivers. And I have a book actually coming out next year, and I've only been working on it for like 9 years. So it's been a process. But something I talk about is what we allow to happen by working with people who do not typically get a chance to be up in front of the public showing their work is we get to kind of change the relationship that we have with people who serve us, right? So the folks who keep my water running or my power on, I never see them. I don't know who they are. I know because I've been out in the field that it takes hundreds of hands to get my power working, but I don't know who they are and who their stories are. And so there's this customer client relationship that really stays one way. And when we create performance that allows people who are really essential to all of our lives, right, to tell their story, we get to change that dynamic and really use what we know in artists is we create an audience. And we create an audience that can, you know, do all the things that audiences do, you know, appreciate, learn. But we get to adjust, I think, that relationship even the tiniest bit. And I think that's the powerful thing of using art in this way.
The 20th anniversary of Forklift occurred during the pandemic, but you found a way to celebrate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, like all of us, we were shocked and particularly when you're in the arts and you're about gathering people in person, what do? We really responded initially by just reaching out to our people, to our collaborators. Chrissy and I both thought, well, now is a good time to check in with some of our friends in sanitation and Empower and the campus crews who are having to do all this new kinds of cleaning and food service. So we started just doing some phone calls to say, how are you doing? What is it like for you? And then we realized, well, there were some stories here to tell and that we could be of service. We could be useful. Again, I like to say, how can we make ourselves as artists indispensable? We could be of service to the larger community by helping to continue to share these stories. So we started this project called On the Job, which actually we're still continuing, where we did telephone interviews that then we edited down and shared with people online, along with photographs about what people's lives were like. And, you know, what was it like now to try to clean a dorm building or box up thousands of meals every day in a campus? And we actually got work groups talking to each other, which was really fun. We were able to do a Zoom call that brought together sanitation workers from Barcelona, Rotterdam, Philadelphia, and Austin. And they got to talk about what was common across the world in terms of how there was so much more trash to pick up, what was different about the places that they were working. But oh my God, I actually share something with another worker halfway across the world. When I get to see workers talking to workers, then I think then that is very gratifying for me. So that's how we celebrated.
Given the amount of time that you spend researching before you begin to choreograph, the amount of money that you need must be fairly substantial. So funding, raising money, and I know you've gotten grants from the NEA, and I wonder what they've enabled you to do.
Oh, yes. Well, so the first time I got any national funding, I think was in 2013 for Power Up. And I remember we got a MAP grant and a Mid-America Arts Alliance grant, and we might have gotten our first NEA then. And I remember jumping up and down with joy because it had taken a while. And it does, it takes a lot of tenacity to get national funding in the art scene. I mean, there's not enough. There's a lot of competition. And I think you have to prove your credibility, you know, which takes time. And particularly in our field, community-based art making takes documentation. You know, it takes being able to have the resources to gather the, you know, the video team to come shoot the work. Again, totally luck. A remarkable artist named Andy Garrison met me in 2008 and decided to make this beautiful documentary, Trash Dance, about the project with the sanitation department. And that really changed everything in terms of funding. I finally had high quality documentation of the work that was beautiful, that helped tell the story. And then the NEA, I remember we applied to the R-Town. I wrote the first R-Town grant in 2015. It was like a master's thesis. I mean, it took hours and hours. I got lots of help from experts who were familiar with R-Town and could help me learn how to write something like that. And then I remember when we got the award and I screamed out loud in the Wesleyan cafeteria because it was for $100,000 and I had never seen a number that big, you know, coming in with a single grant. So that award really did allow us to scale up, to hire more artists, and importantly, hire and commission additional artists and build the team to really respond to what was in front of us. And I do think that NEA Our Town grant in particular gave us visibility that helped us get additional funding from organizations like the Bloomberg Philanthropies, which is doing a lot of work now with cities and in climate change. So, you know, it's just tenacity. It's 24 hours, 7 days a week work, the fundraising. But the larger grants that you can get from the federal government and also from foundations really do make a difference in building sustainability. But no, we're fundraising now for 2024. We're always about a year ahead. But that's what I like to be. You just keep at it one day at a time.
I would end by asking what's next for Forklift, but I assume your project, The Way of Water, is continuing to unfold.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to Venice in January because The Way of Water will be a global project that we're working on with watershed protection. We have a site here in Austin, but we'll also be working in Miami with Miami-Dade County and their cultural arts facility. Miami being the most endangered city in our country due to climate change and rising sea level. We're talking with leadership in El Paso, and I'm also making a proposal to Venice that they also be a site. So the idea is to bring frontline workers together across the world who are confronting water issues, but also neighborhood leadership and city leadership and activists and, of course, artists. So I'm going to go try to make some meetings happen and see if I can begin to lay the groundwork for a partnership there with the water and sanitation employees. Because in Venice, the employees who manage water are also part of the same group who manages trash. And when the floods before the pandemic in the fall of 2019 happened in Venice, it was the sanitation workers who were really the unsung heroes of the city, moving trash, you know, that was floating everywhere and basically keep the city habitable. So there's much love there for the sanitation workers. It's a really interesting situation. So more to come as that project evolves.
I look forward to it. And I think that is a great place to leave it. Allison, thank you. And thank you for the extraordinary work that you do.
Absolutely. You are welcome to come to Austin and come job shadow with us anytime.
That was the founder and artistic director of Forklift Dance Works, Allison Orr. To find out more about Forklift and their many collaborations, go to forkliftdanceworks.org and treat yourself and check out their extraordinary work on YouTube. You can find links in our show notes, as well as a link to my 2011 two-part podcast with Liz Lerman. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Please follow us wherever you get your podcasts and then leave us a rating on Apple. It helps people to find us. And let us know what you think about Artworks. Email us at artworkspod@arts.gov. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.